Lunchtime Live on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.
Finding yourself as a victim of coercive control is an extremely frightening situation. Ruth Dodsworth is a presenter with ITV Wales and has been a victim of this form of domestic abuse, and she joins me on the line now. Ruth, thank you very much for joining me on the show. Was there ever any early signs for you?
It's interesting, Sinead, because I was married to Jonathan for nearly 18 years. And people have asked me, as you have, you know, early signs and did you recognise them? At the time, I knew things weren't right. But I think, you know, like every other new couple, you go into your marriage and you want to make things work. And when little things start happening and you know, he would lose his temper, and you sort of justify it. You want to make things work, as I said. And actually, there's an element of his sort of possessiveness and the jealousy of actually being, in a strange way, it's quite nice. It makes you think, oh, OK, you know, this is all right. But actually, that sort of behaviour then escalated quite quickly. And very soon on into our marriage, things like his temper, things like his wanting to know my whereabouts and so on, really sort of became more and more obvious. And I think at the time, you don't really see the wood for the trees, especially in a relationship and a married relationship where, you know, you rely on that partner, that person, they are your world. But hindsight is an amazing thing. And actually, in the later years, when his behaviour really did get worse, to the point where he was phoning me hundreds of times a day. If I was at work, he wanted to know where I was. I have quite a public role, so my job involves meeting a lot of people. In the latter years, he wanted to know who I was meeting. If it was a man, almost he would come with me, because such was his jealousy and possessiveness that really any man he thought was maybe someone I was having an affair with, which I wasn't. Mm. You know, and that behaviour sort of got worse and worse. Hundreds and hundreds of photographs that he took of me around the house. And his reason, his answer for everything whenever I questioned him was always, because you're my wife.
And that sounds almost like, I mean, what you're describing there is stalking behaviour. And normally, yes, when we think about stalking, we think about a stranger or maybe somebody you are only acquainted with, not somebody that you're living with 24/7.
It's a fine line between the two. So in my particular case, the charge of coercive and controlling behaviour here in Wales, that came into force back in 2015. So even though effectively his behaviour had demonstrated those traits really from day one, in court, he could only really take into account anything that happened from that time onwards. He was arrested for that. But then with Jonathan, the separate charge of stalking came into force, because when he was on bail, he was determined to swap cars, and he put a tracker on my car and very quickly was turning up in places where he shouldn't have been, had no reason to be. He was messaging the children saying, has mum left for work? And they'd say yes. And he'd say, no, I know she hasn't. So that separate charge of stalking then related to the tracker that he put in my car. But it's a fine line between the two. And again, when you're in a relationship and married to somebody, it's very, very difficult to know whether you can prove that. And I think for me, that was always a worry, my word against his. And would a court actually believe me?
What was your tipping point to get help, Ruth, or to do something about it?
It took confiding in someone else to make me get help. Bearing in mind I'd lived like this for the best part of 18 years. When you're in that situation, I had no control over my money. I'd effectively been cut off from family and friends, isolated. I hadn't told anybody. Nobody knew. And I think for me, the decision to get help, because actually I thought staying was better for the children. Staying in the situation was actually the easier option. I didn't know how I was going to get out of it, but it took confiding in one person, just one person, who said to me, Ruth, if you don't ring the police, I will. And that really for me was the turning point. His behaviour one particular night where he drank so much, and alcohol was a common theme for much of our marriage on his part. The children rang me when I was in work and said, Mum, he's being violent and abusive. Don't come home because he's going to kill you. And I think if I had gone home that night, he would have done.
Were you ever worried for the safety of your own children, Ruth?
Do you know, everything that Jonathan did to me over the years, at no point did he show any sign of physical abuse towards the children. So that particular night, I knew that my mum and dad, their grandparents were just around the corner. Mm. They assured me that they were safe. Mm. And so in a sense, I had no choice but to leave them. But deep down, I knew he wouldn't hurt them. His anger and aggression was always directed towards me. And you could argue whether I did the right thing by leaving them. But at that particular night, I knew they were okay. And I knew they were in constant contact with me. I think, in a sense, I had no choice. I couldn't have gone home. And my children are slightly older. They at the time, they were 15, 16. Mm. So they were able, in a sense, to make a decision. And the decision they made was to tell me not to come home.
Wow. They sound like brave kids. And that must have been a very damaging thing for them. I mean, you say they weren't in any physical danger, but their mental health must have been affected by that whole thing.
As I've said to you, Sinead, that really the physical mental abuse in my marriage started from day one. And so as children, you know, you want to protect them. You hope that they don't see things. You hope they don't hear things. But obviously they do. When they were younger, it was easier to hide it make excuses for daddy shouting. But actually, the older they got, they saw and heard everything and saw and heard things no children should ever have to see. And at the moment, they're fine. And, you know, mentally, they're fine. They're talking. They're physically strong. My worry, I suppose, is, as any parent is, but, you know, what happens in the future and whether this is something, the repercussions further down the line.
Yeah.
You know, it might have affected them in ways that I just don't know. But I'm their mum and I'll do my utmost to protect them and make sure that they're safe.
Now, a common refrain that we do hear, unfortunately, with victims of domestic abuse, coercive control and women who are in this position is maybe from people who don't fully understand it. You know, they might say, well, why didn't you just leave? There are refuges, there are places of safety that you can go. It has always been a crime, physical abuse. So what stopped you doing that?
This is such a tough question to answer. Even now, I struggle with the whole phrase domestic abuse. I don't know. I think I'm only now coming to terms that my situation, the way I was living, even though I knew it wasn't right, was classed as domestic abuse. Mm. And as I said, in a strange way, when you've got no financial backing, no money, even though I've got a loving family, I hadn't told any of my family or my friends what was going on. And I had been isolated over the years and become increasingly dependent on Jonathan. He made, you know, himself the focus of my world. And it's so difficult to pack a bag. Where do you go? I mean, I know there are shelters and there are refuges, but actually to ask someone for help is possibly one of the hardest things. And as I said, at the end of the day, it was easier to stay. It was such a hard decision to move.
Yes.
And it took someone else to make that, effectively take that decision out of my hands and make that for me.
Did you feel that you were kind of, I suppose in one sense there was a bit of you thinking, if I admit this to somebody else, I'm admitting the failure of my marriage. I'm admitting maybe I did something here, which of course you didn't do. Was there that sense of that worry about this is nearly better than what might come next?
Absolutely. You know, it's humiliating, it's embarrassing, it's degrading to have to talk about some of the worst things, that the mental, the physical things, admitting to yourself, let alone admitting to anyone else about what on earth was going on in your marriage. There was the whole, no one else in my family has ever been divorced. There's the sense of, even now, that a worry of the stigma of divorce, of being a single mum. So many things come into play. But it is admitting, in a sense, that failure and that the life you've been living has been a complete sham. And to the outside world, my life was perfect. But actually, behind closed doors, it was far from it.
Now, your husband, Jonathan Wignall, was jailed in Cardiff, by Cardiff Crown Court. It was described in court that he had a fragile ego, quote unquote. Are you worried about him getting out, Ruth?
This is something that I worry about daily. The court case and the trial was traumatic in its sense. And in a strange way, the fact that he was sentenced to prison was actually, it was never my intention. It was never my goal. It was never been about being vindictive or punishment.
You just wanted it to stop.
I wanted it to stop. And I wanted him to stand there and say guilty. The judge, when he summed up, said that Jonathan at no stage, and even now, has ever shown any sense of remorse. And in a sense, that worries me, because even though he's away now, he will get through this. And in a relatively short space of time, next year, he will be out. He won't be tagged. He won't be on a curfew. He will be out, effectively a free man. And the fear is that there's never any closure. This doesn't ever go away. And even though he served his time, I will always be looking at my shoulder. I will always be in his mind, his property, his wife. And I have to carry on living, wondering where he is once he's released, what he's doing. And I know he will come out of prison a very angry man. He's got a lot of time on his hands now, and he's not shown any remorse, and I don't think, hand on heart, he ever will. It will always be my fault. And I am concerned, and I do worry that, you know, he has time to think about this. He has time to work out what he's going to do when he does come out. And the judge described him as a danger to me and the children, and that's not going to change. He will always be a danger. And so, yes, I do worry, and I think so many other people are in the same situation. There is no closure in this type of case.
Ruth Dodsworth, I wish you all the very best of luck for you and your children in the future, and thank you for coming on to Lunchtime Live today to tell us your story.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Now, Patricia Rickard-Clark is the chairperson of Safeguarding Ireland, and she joins me on the line. Now, Patricia, you're welcome to Lunchtime Live. How common are situations like Ruth's?
Sinead, good afternoon, and thank you for inviting me on, first of all, to acknowledge the very difficult circumstances that Ruth was in, but glad to hear and good to hear that she eventually received support. So coming back to your question then about how common it is, the situation here is that, and while Ruth has indicated it's been a crime in Wales since 2015, coercive control is a crime here under our domestic violence legislation. But it is confined to people who are or who have been in an intimate relationship. So it doesn't include it as a crime for people who are in close adult relationships. Mm. So we did our survey, and in fact, the figures are quite startling in the sense that quite a number of people really don't know or understand what coercive control is. And to ask you, answer your direct question is, 25% of the people who we did ask said that they were aware of coercive control outside of intimate relationships. And really, that's what our public awareness is all about. It's about people realising coercive control covers all particular circumstances.
Well, give us an idea, Patricia, of what kind of things are included in coercive control. I mean, we heard Ruth there talking about her money being withheld, a tracker put on her car, hundreds of text messages. Yes. What other signs are
there? So if you take, say, what we would describe as people at risk, or people who are subject to it more than others, older people or people with intellectual or physical disabilities. So the types of things we're talking about is really that whole controlling a person's behaviour, their choices, their movements. So detaining a person at home, for example, restricting a person's movements, constant monitoring of a person's whereabouts, preventing contact with family or friends. And this happens a lot in families. Some family members don't want their parent or their grandparent to have contact with other family members or indeed grandchildren. Withholding grandchildren access is one of the things. Controlling money and controlling decisions around medical care. Imposing and making decisions on behalf of somebody else. And this is particularly prevalent where you have older, frail people who have capacity, can make their decisions, but actually people just making decisions on their behalf. Or again, people with disabilities. Yeah. People tend to take over and make decisions on their behalf, not recognising themselves, you know, as their independent right to make their independent decisions.
Yeah, now we heard, like, Ruth is obviously very articulate and smart and holding a public job. Yes. And as she said herself, her life from the outside seemed perfect. So she's not somebody that you would initially view as vulnerable or as, you know, unable to see this for what it is. But actually, she didn't see it for what it is. And do you believe that there are, say, victims in Ireland who just don't see it until maybe other people pointed out to them that they are under this level of control?
Yes, absolutely. Coercive control is very, very difficult to detect. it's very subtle and difficult, even from an outsider looking into a relationship, looking into an intimate relationship. On the other hand, looking into a relationship where one person trusts or is dependent on another, so they're receiving care or help or assistance from another, it can seem from the outside as a very caring relationship. It may not be. So it is hard to spot. On the other hand, then, people who are in such a relationship find it very difficult. Sometimes, because as the behaviour worsens and the incidence of abuse increases, it becomes the norm for that person and they put up with it. And also then they're isolated and they don't reach out and they're embarrassed, as Ruth said, to seek help and support. So it's really important that we all have our antenna up and really try and talk to people and communicate to people without interfering with their own lives or whatever.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because there is that tipping point between, you know, you may witness this happening to a family member or a friend and not be sure about whether to intervene or not. We're told that it can be very dangerous for women, to have their abuser challenged or highlighted in any way.
Indeed. And, you know, organisations, the Women's Aid and other organisations, are very careful again about contact. But again, it can be difficult when you're in that controlling relationship, if your phone has been monitored or your movements, to make contact with the outside world. So, but we should all keep an eye and assist anybody and have confidential lines. We don't even have legal framework here for safeguarding. We're lacking that adult safeguarding. We don't have one central point. That was one of the things that came up in our survey. 39% of the people did not know who to contact if they needed advice about helping somebody.
Indeed.
And while organisations, like in domestic abuse situations, people are more aware of numbers, etc., outside of that intimate relationship or family situations, they're not aware of who to contact.
Okay.
So that public awareness is really important.
And who should they contact?
It's the Gardaí. There's a confidential Gardaí line, 1800 666 111. There's also a HSE social care number, safeguarding teams, 061 461 358. Also, in fact, while obviously the majority of people who are subject to coercive control are women, there are also men that are subject to coercive control. So on our website, we've the men's network contact, Safe Ireland and Women's Aid. So really important, if people have issues, that they do make contact. And, people are very aware then. I mean, we should be in a position where once a call is made, we recognise that's a cry for help without delaying the person on the phone who may be under pressure to deliver a clear message. So really important that, you know, the whole public awareness around this and our laws are expanded and we have a proper framework for dealing with it.
Now, we've seen one person jailed earlier in the year for coercive control. Is it very difficult to charge?
No, I think it's since the 2019 Domestic Violence Act was increased, there's a few people have been charged, one certainly jailed. But it's again the awareness, people being aware that that is an offence there. But we do need that offence, as I say, in other contexts as well.
All right.
We should all be aware of it.
OK, all right. Patricia Rickard-Clark, Chairperson of Safeguarding Ireland, and Ruth Dodsworth before that. Thank you for joining me here on Lunchtime Live on News Talk to speak about this very powerful and also difficult issue.
Lunchtime Live on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.